Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments. The Church, Patron of Arts. The Sistine Chapel Revisited. And our weekly rendezvous with our popular Latin lover. Thanks so much for joining me once again. On Thursday, 10th of September, here in the Vatican, in the course of a press conference, an unusual event was announced, a meeting between Benedict XVI and artists, scheduled for November 21st this year, timed to coincide 10 years since John Paul II wrote a letter to artists, and almost half a century since Paul VI's landmark encounter with artists in the Sistine Chapel. But why don't you join me as I step back in time for a moment in this backgrounder of sorts I've prepared for you. One doesn't often think of Pope Benedict XVI as a patron of art and artists, but clearly he is. In fact, by announcing his November encounter with artists on November 21st, he confirms his intention to follow along the fruitful path of dialogue that has taken place over the centuries between the Church and artists. One that has a landmark date in the 20th century with the pontificate of Paul VI, the Pope who fostered a memorable encounter with artists almost half a century ago. The date is May 7, 1964. Paul VI invites artists to join him in the heart of the Vatican, in that cenacle of artists, the Sistine Chapel. On this occasion, he says in Italian to those gathered around him, "Have artists ever gathered around the Pope like this before?"
Sono mai venuti gli artisti a Papa? È una prima volta anche questa, forse.
Paul VI is out to provoke. He knows all too well that for centuries, the Church and art had enjoyed an extremely prolific love affair.
There was historically that connection between the Church and art, but then there was an estrangement for some time, and Paul VI wanted to recall that, to bring back that relationship that had existed for centuries.
American Cardinal Edmund Schocker knew Pope Paul VI personally. I asked him what it was in Paul VI's personality that made him such a patron of art and artists. Cardinal Schocker says it stems from a combination of great sensitivity and radiant spirituality.
It does not surprise me that he would have a great interest in art because of his deep spirituality and because art ultimately expresses the spiritual. And I think that it'd be just a sort of natural consequence of his own deep spirituality and his ability to see beyond the material to the transcendence of everything. I think it was a natural consequence of that ability that he would have such a great interest in art.
At any rate, what Paul VI was forced to admit back in 1964 is that at some stage that love affair dwindled, marking a decline destined to last for almost 2 centuries.
As he says this, his voice wavers wistfully.
Siamo sempre stati amici, ma come avviene fra parenti, come avviene anche fra amici, ci si è un po' guastati.
I was fascinated to read that speech by Pope Paul because the church had lost its way a little bit with artists. There was no more patronage in the Renaissance sense. All the energy seemed to go on stressing the mind and the consistency, the logic of what the church had to teach. Very much a world of words, whereas the images lost out.
Monsignor Peter Fleetwood, for many years an official at the Vatican's office which deals with art and artists.
During that speech, the Pope says that the church abandoned artists, but the artists abandoned the church as well. Is that right?
Yeah, they'd each gone their own way. He wanted to apologise, which is a remarkable thing. You don't often hear that from a Pope. And it was a very humble, avuncular kind of speech. It was saying the Pope is your friend. I really want to be you to be sure of this, that you're very welcome in the church and we should get back together. You've gone off losing the standards that you used to hold so dear and stopped reflecting a beauty that mattered very much to the church.
Ci avete un po' abbandonato. Siete andati lontani a bere ad altre fontane.
The Pope's voice is hesitant and shy as he begins chastising artists for abandoning the church. But before long, the strength of the Pope's commitment to art surfaces from that silent shyness, spiraling into a cry of vehement reproval.
Dimenticate il canone fondamentale della vostra consacrazione all'espressione. Non si sa che cosa dite. Non lo sapete tante volte neanche voi. Diventa un linguaggio di Babele, di confusione. E allora, dov'è l'arte?
No longer does he whisper, I don't want to offend you here today, but you did lower your standards, lost sight of true inspiration, your art became offensive to humanity. And what is the result? Confusion, a Tower of Babel.
Artists had gone their own way, in a way that really he thought the church couldn't always approve of, like not looking to standards of decency or beauty in the classic senses. The effect of different currents of thought left its mark on the church as well, and there was too much rational thinking taking over. And the thing that lost out was the emotional side, or the more explicitly artistic side in people's character.
But while Paul VI does rap artists over the knuckles, he also admits to the church's responsibility, its failure to foster art, a failure that brought the church's image as patron of art and artists to an end. Paul VI explains why. He attributes it to a clash between artists' boundless creativity and the church's imposition of styles and limiting rules and regulations in the field of art.
I hope you enjoyed that feature I put together for you. Meanwhile, as we've just been speaking about the Sistine Chapel, let's join a professor of fine arts there. Her name is Breda Ennis, and she takes us by the hand to help us better discover the works of art on the walls of the Sistine Chapel.
Yeah.
going to zoom in on the Last Judgment. Are you going to speak to me about the goodies or the baddies right at the bottom of the fresco?
Well, I prefer the goodies today.
Okay, so
because I'm feeling in a good mood.
To focus on the exact point, they're the ones on...
On the left side of...
As you look at the great fresco of the Last Judgment.
Yes.
Let's begin by putting the spotlight on the central figure in this fresco with a wonderful cornflower blue backdrop.
Just run your eye in a straight line right up. You'll start on the top and you'll have Christ with this extraordinary hand raised in judgment, but judgment in a majestic and very spiritual way, not judgment in the way we tend to think of judgment when we do it ourselves sometimes, you know. And then you have the Madonna at his side, looking very compassionate and very serene, but you can see that she feels for what is about to happen. And then just way below them, you have the angels calling on the dead to arise and be judged. And then just below them again, at the bottom, you have this horrible little hole in the ground full of demons, devils, every kind of imaginable awful stuff.
Brida, earlier I mentioned the blue... But Michelangelo also painted in a bit of green land, no?
Obviously, he had to have the land to have the people resurrect from the dead, from the burial. And here in the middle, you have this chamber of devils, which is terrifying to look at and ghastly. I think he must have worked very seriously at getting the most horrible expressions that he could possibly find. If you think of the entire fresco of the Last Judgment as this continual tension between the good and the bad, and salvation and damnation. Michelangelo was able to express this tension just using the body and the minimal elements of nature like clouds, ground here, and some rocks, but very little. So at the bottom here on the left-hand side, you have a group of people who are in a sort of green piece of land with behind it, strangely enough, something that looks like to me like distant mountains. If the person who is looking at the fresco just concentrates very specifically on the figures, you will find at the back almost very pale tinted figures that are not completely painted. And then in front of that, then you find just at that type of, let's say, horizon of land, you'll find a skeleton dressed. And then just beside that, again, you find another person who's already becoming reformed and coming out of a shroud, trying to look upwards. And then you have other people who've already come out of the ground who are looking towards the other people. And the people who've come out and are completely out are all looking up towards Christ at the top part of the fresco. Then you have various, for example, here, this is a very dramatic figure here on the left, just to the immediate left of the devil's area, you have this figure who's being pulled up. He's reformed, he's resurrected, he's being pulled up by a good angel. Now, these are angels without wings.
He's upside down.
Yeah, he's upside down. He's literally been pulled up because below you will see that there is a devil with horns. They're trying to pull him back down again. So even when there is the resurrection, you have this almost like this battle going on between...
A tug of war.
Yeah, tug of war between the good angels and the baddies, you know, and the devils, you know, the bad angels, let's say, because they are. And they were... And they were good angels at one point and became bad angels. And here the figure, you see this figure pulling the hair. I mean, you can feel the tension. You'd almost feel that he's just going to split in two, this figure. So to do this in painting terms is quite difficult, to create this massive tension. So what he does here, Michelangelo, is there's one figure, one of the angels, is wearing a green robe and literally has the legs of this gentleman over the back, over the shoulders, pulling, and then there's another angel nearby trying to give a little bit of help, let's say. So you can imagine this angel holding the legs at the other side of the figure. So this massive tug of war going on, as you say, to pull this person up into the heavenly area. And the devil is not actually wasting his energy below either, because you can see him pulling just as hard below.
There's two angels for a devil.
Yes. Yeah, well, this devil is also, you see the way he's painted. Yes, he is, actually. And then next to him, look at this other figure here. Very muscular figures. There's another person being pulled up again by an angel, but you can see that they still have part of the funeral robes around them. So it's almost like they're just being they've almost, look, they look like they've just woken up and sort of a bit sort of dazed, you know. And
there's an amazing amount of things going on there.
Yeah. And again, you see here, if you look at the colour of the skin on the figures here, those who are completely formed and who actually look alive are more near the natural colour of the human body. And as we go up, let's say, to the left side of the frescoes, you go up into the sky, now where the people are actually released from the ground, they're fully formed and they're being pulled up towards the heavenly area, and you have angels leaning over clouds, trying to help them, to pull them up. And the other angels are just pulling and pushing, but trying to get them up. And you have saints coming down to bring them up and help them. And again, you see these two figures here. There's a figure dressed in green and one in red. And they're leaning over the side of a cloud to help a figure. This figure has already, he's already made it, actually. But you see the skin of this person here and this person as well here. Three or four of them, let's say. And they all have skin that looks more human. Down here, you see that the skin is grey. So it's the colour skin of the skin is more to...
of a corpse.
Well, yes, in fact, yeah, in fact. So you're going from a skeleton to a corpse, to a semi-corpse, and then figures who are half-formed. And again, here there's a figure of a monk, dressed as a monk here, you see, helping a nun in the resurrection coming out of the grave. And then underneath, just above the door in the Sistine Chapel, which I believe is the room where the Room of Tears, no? It's just there to the left of the main altar when the Pope is elected. Just above that, you also see a figure crawling out from under a tombstone. And it's half yes and half no. It's the figure is going to come out and join the other figures who are already formed. But it's interesting to see that some of the figures, when they come out of the ground, almost like they rest their arms like they're exhausted from the process. So you get the feeling that the actual act of resurrection
is a struggle.
It's a struggle. When they come out, the devils are also waiting to try and get as many of them as they can. And you see here, there's another figure just behind. This man has just come out. Again, he's very near the door on the left-hand side of the chapel. You see here, he's leaning his knee, his foot on the ground there, and he has his two arms and his hands pressed on the ground. And right behind him, you can see actually a skeleton with the face with the empty eye sockets, dressed again in the funeral robes. It's very strange. And way down at the bottom, here is a figure which some people theorize belonging to Michelangelo, where he's actually dressed in the robes, looking out at the spectator. Because most of the figures in the Last Judgment are looking up towards Christ, trying to struggle or looking at the angels who are trying to save them. This figure here is looking out into the chapel. You can actually feel him, see him looking out into the chapel. And it's almost like Michelangelo is saying, "Let me out of this fresco, if you don't mind." I've come to the end. But you just get this feeling like he's just going to fall into the chapel. It's very nice. I mean, I would say that that's a lovely piece of Baroque painting. Because, I mean, you always think of Baroque painting as the figures in Baroque paintings are just ready to move out of the painting and get involved with what you're doing, or vice versa. They invite you into the painting to get involved in what they're doing in the painting. And here you have this Michelangelo figure-like person struggling out of the ground, out of his grave, to fall into the chapel. And it's you're the next one. Or
so Baroque artists didn't invent anything.
No, I don't think so. I think they just elaborated things that were already floating around. But again, you see, if when you look at this lovely movement, it's very melodic. It's very musical, the Last Judgment for me. It's music and expression. And all the faces, well, if you think about 400 figures in the entire fresco, and every expression is different, every single expression, there are no two that are alike. And this lovely feeling of floating up, and then this other feeling of pulling down, and this other feeling of struggling to get out of a space that's confined like a grave, obviously, and then struggling to, let's say, get your skin back on you, and then to try and figure out which side of the scales you're going to be going on.
And a big thank you there to our Professor of Fine Arts, Breda Ennis, for sharing with us her expertise in the field of sacred art. Professor Ennis is currently teaching at the American University of Rome. Finally, as always at this time of week, it's time to join our popular Latin lover. He's, as you know, Carmelite, Father Reginald Foster. Stay tuned. Father Reginald Foster, I publicly apologise. Why, you may wonder? Well, simply because at a moment when he had plenty of other things to do, I bullied him to come in to translate an address of Pope Paul VI to the Archbishop of Canterbury, Michael Ramsay. The date was the 23rd of March, 1966, the place, the Sistine Chapel, and the language, well, Latin, of course. Just listen. Can you remember the meeting between Paul VI and Archbishop Ramsay?
I do remember those things.
On this occasion, the Archbishop of Canterbury spoke in English, but Pope Paul VI spoke in Latin, which he had a very peculiar brand of Latin, no?
Well, I mean, of his secretaries. And 66, I wasn't there, of course.
They met in the Sistine Chapel, right? How do you say Sistine Chapel in Latin?
Sacellum or Sacellum Sixtinum.
Why Sacellum?
Is it like a small sanctuary, chapel? That's what we say, Sacellum Sistinum.
16 or Sistinum?
Sixtinum, XY.
Because I have the speech in Latin, and do you want to listen to it at all? He says, the world looks on, and he says, Mundus aspicit historia.
Aspicit.
Mundus aspicit historia. Memorabit.
The world looks on. History will remember or recall.
Renovas quidem egregium illud humanitatis officium.
You repeat, indeed, that outstanding sign of goodness.
Quod accessor tuus illustris et honorabilis, Godefridus Fischer, desideratissimum decessorem nostrum felicis recordationis Ioannem vigesimum tertium est prosecutus.
By which your predecessor, the illustrious and honorable Gottfried Fischer, got it?
It's Jeffrey Fischer.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, you say Gottfried, you say Jeffrey, okay. Accompanied our most longed for predecessor of happy memory, John the 23rd.
Id agens quasi reficis pontem. Having non nulla secula recissum.
Doing this, you, as it were, remake the bridge, cut down many centuries ago.
Quae ecclesia romana et cantuariensis inter se erant coniuncte.
By which the Roman Church and the Church of Canterbury had been joined among themselves. That makes sense as you're following there?
I'm following, not in English, I'm following in Italian. Because
oh, I don't
find
care.
An English text.
Pontem dicimus.
Pontem dicimus. We're talking about this bridge.
Quo vincula reverentiae, bone estimationis et caritatis significantur.
By the way, these are glorious words. We are talking about the bridge by which the bonds of reverence of good esteem and charity are designated.
Why are they so special, these words?
I mean, the whole idea is out of this world. If we just do it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's up to that point.
Mm-hmm. And then I tried to pick, for our listeners, I tried to highlight some of the points that I find particularly significant or I find particularly poetic. For example, the next paragraph.
Te non in domum extraneam ingredi, set in domum quam semper vigente titulo etiam tuam potes appellare.
You should feel that you are entering not a foreign house, but into a house which you are always able to call even your own, vigente titulo, with a flourishing title.
Gaudemus sianum tibi aperire.
We are happy to open the door for you.
What is the door?
Januam.
Januam.
Janitor.
That's where janitor comes from.
Well, certainly. What do you expect?
Et cum ea animum pandere nostrum.
The doors of our heart.
Well, okay. And with that door, to expand our own spirit.
Letamur enim et honore officimur.
Hey, this is out of this world. And honore ad hanc temporis opportunitatem verba sancti Pauli transferences, secundum quae te accipimus. We are happy, and we are filled with honor. Transferring to this opportunity of time, the words of St. Paul, according to which we take you in. Non ut hospitem et advenam. Huh? Not as a guest and a stranger. Sed ut civem sanctorum et domesticum Dei. But as a citizen of the saints.
And the family of God.
And a household man of God. Gregorius Magnus et Sanctus Augustinus, Ceritus certe intuentur et benedico. Isn't that glorious?
And looking down from the sky.
St. Gregory the Great and St. Augustine, certainly from heaven, are looking on and are blessing.
That's beautiful.
Well, certainly it is. We've lost everything.
And a big thank you there to Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, better known as our popular Latin lover. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks for joining me. Don't forget, we'll be back again at this same time tomorrow. Meanwhile, should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now. You'll be listening to the English program of Vatican Radio, Laudetur Jesus Christus.